I'm going to make a note here. According to Mike Cohn, if you want to be successful with Agile, have your team wax your car.
That, that might be a good way to go about it. Have your team wax your car and then teach them that they just learned how to be Agile.
There you go.
So, could be a way to do it.
I'm Brian Milner, and this is the Agile Mentors Podcast, a show about both the personal and organizational journey towards agility. My friends and I will be sharing with you what we've collectively learned from seeing thousands of companies' Agile implementations, the perils and pitfalls, as well as the secrets to success. We'll share our personal in-the-trenches experiences so that you can apply what we've learned in a practical way in your careers. We also hope to hear and learn from you as well. If you're like us and are always in search of better ways of working together, you're in the right place. Join us, mentor, and be mentored. Let's get started. Seeing as this is a new podcast and really one of the first times that we've done something like this at Mountain Goat Software, wanted to just talk through a little bit about why. Why do we decide to do a podcast? What are we trying to accomplish here with this? Well, what we want is we want a show that's for agilists of all levels. Whether you're just starting to figure out about this thing called Agile or Scrum, or whether you've been doing this for, I don't know, 5+ years, right? You're an old pro at this. We want there to be material from this podcast that will apply to all of you, that will stick, that will help, that can help push you further down this Agile road. We want this show to be practical. I want to make sure that the advice that we pass on to you and the things that we talk about is not just, you know, pie in the sky, not this theory kind of stuff that I don't really know how I could apply this, but I know the guests and people that we're going to have come through this have all done this, have all been in organizations and experienced it firsthand. So I want to make sure that we're sharing that kind of information with you, that up close personal experience of people who've been in the trenches. That's the kind of advice we want to share here in the podcast. I also think it's really important. I think it's part of really what I think is Mountain Goat's brand is more of a pragmatic approach versus a dogmatic approach. So many people out there that train or talk about Agile in some way take this sort of almost hardline, religious type of stance on Agile, and that you must do it a certain way exactly. And we've never really taken that point of view. I've really appreciated that even before I was part of Mountain Goat, just that concept of there's different experiences. People have different scenarios, different situations, and one solution isn't going to apply to everybody. That's silly. That's crazy to think that we could do that. Now, there are some common learnings, obviously, and that's what we hope to share. But there's very few things that I feel like I teach in class where I say, this is the way it must be done. This is the only way to do this. And in fact, I don't know if there's anything that I say that way. Scrum definitely has some core ways that it tries to get us to do things. But even there, I think once your team becomes mature enough, it's about inspecting and adapting. So that's what I hope that we were able to do here for you in this podcast is really make this practical, give you a pragmatic kind of approach to this, and reach out to you wherever you are in your Agile journey. So here we are. It's episode 001. I'm being optimistic. And maybe I should, if I'm really optimistic, I'd add another zero there. But we are here and we're excited to be here. This is fun. We've been looking forward to doing this for a long time. And I think this is going to be fun. With me for our inaugural kickoff episode is the one and only Mike Cohn.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for setting this up.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate you lending your time and talents and expertise with us here, Mike. It's going to be a lot better having you here. So for this inaugural episode, I thought we'd just kick us off by talking about these two terms that kind of are the large terms that revolve around everything that we do, and that's Agile and Scrum. A lot of people get confused by these two terms. A lot of people think they may be synonyms. Is there Is there a difference between these two terms? You know, why does it even matter? That sort of stuff. So I thought it would just be good for us to kind of dive into there and talk about it. So I'll throw that out to you, Mike, just to start us off. What do you think are some of the biggest misunderstandings people have when they hear those two terms, Agile and Scrum?
Well, I think they conflate them. They put them together and they think they're the same thing, or that they're 100% different, and that there's a thing called Agile Scrum. I get that all the time, right? People will email and say, we're doing Agile Scrum as opposed to non-Agile Scrum, right? Is there a non-Agile version? We used to hear this with the term lean, right? You'd hear people saying, we're doing lean Agile. And I was like, as opposed to fat Agile, right? I mean, what does this mean? The way I distinguish those terms, I think I've gotten really good at explaining that difference because I had to do it so many times. I think of Agile as what I call an umbrella term. I'm sure there's a better word for that, but I think it's like an umbrella. And Agile embraces a whole bunch of things. It embraces Scrum. So Scrum is one of the Agile approaches. And the way I explain that to people is to say it's just like buying a refrigerator. You go into an appliance store and you want to buy a refrigerator. You look around at a bunch of different brands of refrigerators. And I've learned that from telling this story, I've learned that refrigerator brands are different worldwide. But you know, near me, there's Whirlpool and Maytag and General Electric and Haier and Samsung and a few others. And I buy, let's say, a Whirlpool refrigerator. That's a brand of refrigerator in the same way that Scrum is a brand of Agile. And so I think keeping the distinction that way has seemed to really work for people. It's just Scrum is a brand of Agile. Whirlpool is a brand of refrigerator.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to put it. Refrigerators and brands of refrigerators. I've stolen that. I use that in my class as well. I've heard you say that before.
Good.
But this stuff's kind of hard. I mean, people get stuff wrong about this all. I get stuff wrong about this all the time.
We all do.
Yeah. So what's some stuff that maybe even people who are more experienced about this get wrong? I mean, I was thinking about how a lot of times I see people who put Scrum in all caps on things, right? And like it's an acronym. I used to, you know, make fun of that in class a lot. And I would say, hey, don't put down your resume. You know, don't put it in all caps. But then I actually went back and read the very first white paper. And as you know, the first white paper, they put it in all caps. I don't think there was an intent to have that be any kind of acronym. Back then, maybe you can tell me. Do you know if they had an acronym for it when they started?
No, when Ken Schwaber and Jeff Sutherland first started writing about this, mostly that was in one of the old Usenet news groups, right? Back in the era of Usenet, the early internet days. No, they didn't have an acronym for it. It just kind of got put that way. Sometimes I think things like that begin as a way of just, you know, putting attention on the word, right? Because we'll see that where people will capitalize things like product backlog, right? And make this kind of like, you know, important looking noun. And so I think it was just sometimes a way to get attention to a word. And, you know, when you're scrolling through a Usenet posting, to be able to see it in all capitals was kind of nice in that regard. So I see that. I think things that, I think there's just an amazing number of things that people get wrong. And I wish I remembered this specific example, but I want to start with this because it's about me getting something wrong. I was standing up in front of a class teaching, giving a class, and somebody like on the left side of the room yelled out a question like, you know, Mike, who should do such and such. That was how it started, but don't remember the question. Who should do such and such? And I am about to blurt out the Scrum Master should do such and such. And fortunately, before I said anything, somebody from the other side of the room yelled out, that's up to the team. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's a much better answer than I was about to say. I don't remember what it was, right? But I think that kind of goes to whether you're a natural at Scrum. I don't think I'm a natural at Scrum. I think I came up before as a manager before Scrum was around, and I learned to manage projects in a fairly traditional way. And I think of myself as kind of big, mean, and ugly. And I could get a fair amount of progress by just kind of being intimidating, and not even in a deliberate way, but by just, you know, you're going to be done this weekend, right? And I could just ask that and kind of, yeah, we'll work overtime. I was like, you know, I didn't necessarily mean that, but I certainly didn't mind. And that worked. And when Agile came around, it really was freeing for me. We're in Scrum because Scrum precedes Agile. And when I encountered Scrum, it really was freeing in helping me manage projects a lot better. It was getting around problems I was experiencing where I couldn't make a big project happen by kind of force of will and influencing people in bad ways. So it was really helpful to me, but it went a little against my kind of natural or first 10 year of my career trained style. And so when I was asked whatever that question was, I almost blurted out the wrong answer. And so I see people fall into old habits of, you know, I used to be a project manager. Let me tell the team what to do, right? We do that. I see really bad stuff with people who think everything needs to be a user story, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and I wrote a book on user stories. I don't think everything needs to be a user story, right? I will happily put on a product backlog, upgrade Linux server, right? Apply OS patch. I don't need, you know, as a IT administrator, I need to upgrade the Linux server. It's, no, upgrade Linux server. We all know what that means. No further discussion involved, right? And I think that's a really common mistake that that teams see. One of the big ones, I think, is just taking everything too rigidly. You know, you see people that, you know, oh, we're supposed to do a 10-day sprint, and they then will, like, somebody's out for a holiday, right? We're going to, oh, now we're going to change the day of the sprints. And okay, maybe, but I don't think that's a good idea, because now you're stakeholders have to come to a review on Thursday instead of on Wednesday because we shifted by a day. I was like, no, run a 9-day sprint. Don't take it that literally. So I think those are huge problems that I'll see with teams.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, I think one of the things I appreciated, Mike, you know, just personally, when I was coming up and I would watch your videos and you know, see things that you had posted out there, was the pragmatic kind of approach to things. That, you know, it's not a holy text, you know, it's not a rule book that you have to follow to the letter. It's more about what works. And, if it works, then great. That's what you should do. I tell people that in my class all the time, you know, that there are rules, there are things about Scrum that, you know, you should be following as Scrum says, but, you know, if something's working for you, then, you know, I don't have any really strong desire to change it if it's working.
Well, common sense needs to trump all, right? And so, you know, I hate meetings, right? I really hate meetings. And it's one of the reasons I quit working in companies many years ago. So I hate meetings. I hate commuting, all that type of stuff. And so I hate meetings, but I don't mind if a team tells me they're having 20-minute daily scrums and it's working for them, right? I'm not going to go, oh no, you're violating a rule. It says 15 minutes. It's like, you know, maybe the team's a little bit bigger. Maybe they're, you know, 9, not out of range at all. So maybe they're 9 and maybe they're doing some work that requires a lot of coordination among people. It's very easy to make up a scenario where it's totally worth it for them to have a 20-minute meeting. And so, you know, I've had teams like that that feel like they're breaking a rule and like, you know, we're taking 20 minutes. How can we get it down to a 15? And I start talking, oh, it's super valuable. We love all the conversation, but how do we get it down to 15? I'm like, you don't, right? Let it be 20. Everybody here appreciates that meeting. Nobody's complaining about it. Break the rule. Right.
Yeah. The thing I tell people is there's no Scrum police. There's not going to be somebody who comes knock on your door and telling you that, hey, you're doing this wrong. You're not officially doing Scrum anymore. Do what works, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I send out a weekly tip every Thursday. A lot of subscribers, this kind of weekly email is like 500-word email. And I mentioned a comment in a class in Copenhagen a few years ago about there are no Scrum police. And somebody's like, please put that in one of your weekly tips so I can share it with my boss, right? Because her boss was apparently the Scrum police, right? And they would do everything by the book. You know, doing it by the book is actually dangerous. In Ken Schwaber's second book, he has this really weird comment. I hate picking on like one sentence in somebody's book, because I got some really horrible comments in my books, sentences that I would love to change, and I'm happy to share some of those. But in his second book, he actually makes a really weird statement. He says the daily scrum must be conducted left to right, starting with the person on the left of the scrum master. And so you go around left to right. And this one scrum master read that in the book and took it seriously. I think most people just kind of glossed over the sentence or said, what? You know, just moved on. This guy took it really seriously. It was making his team go left to right. And he didn't know why he had to, but he had to. So he did. And the team was just messing with him. The team would do things like the scrum master would look to the right person, you know, look to the person on the left, and the person on the right would start talking. And the team would then start pacing back and forth kind of across their circle. So there was no person on the left. I just try to point out the silliness of this rule, right? But, you know, there are those scrum police type of scrum masters, right? And he's like, I got to do it by the book. No, no.
Yeah, I remember when I was becoming a CST, one of the questions I got asked in one of my final reviews was, what would you change about the Scrum Guide? You know, what's something that you didn't like about it? And my response was that in the post section of the Scrum Guide, there's this silly little comment that it says that the rules and...
Oh, immutable.
Yeah, immutable, right. Yep. this is immutable. I'm like, okay, well... Immutable from which version? Because this is now the 2020 version of the Scrum Guide, and it changes all the time.
Yeah, that's insane. I don't understand that there one bit. Because if you go back, and nobody remembers this, there were very few people doing Scrum back in 1995 when I got started doing this. I actually got started in October of 94, just with a couple people on the one project, got really going in January 95, delivered our first kind of big project September of 95. And very few people in the world doing it back then. It was largely discussed on the Usenet news groups back kind of early days of the internet. And back then, people were talking about these things. It was like official Scrum, according to like Jeff Sutherland, that were called sync steps, which were periodic places where you would sync up. The reason they were called sprints is there were gaps between them. You would do a bunch of analysis, figure out what you wanted to build, and then you would sprint to build it. Then you'd go into one of these kind of gap periods where you'd figure things out, you'd sprint to build it. And so, I mean, Scrum has changed tremendously in all the years since then. So to take this attitude of Scrum is immutable, it just doesn't make any sense, right? So Scrum changes all the time. I mean, at its core, I think there are certain things that probably won't ever change. Things like we should inspect and adapt, right? We shouldn't be immutable. I think things like that will stay as principles of Scrum all the time, but its kind of manifestation of the world is changed tremendously over the decades.
Yeah. When I read that word, the little Inigo Montoya phrase goes off in my head saying, I do not think that means what you think it means.
Could be.
Well, one thing that I hear quite a bit when we talk about Agile and particularly Agile implementations or transformations, transitions, whatever word you want to use there, is this whole concept of the culture aspect of it and changing the culture of an organization. Obviously, when we think about things in the Agile Manifesto, there's a lot of cultural type values there. It's a lot of not step-by-step instructions, but things we value this thing over that thing, right? It's more of a cultural kind of statement. So I'm just kind of interested a little bit in your take on that. How important do you see culture versus practices? And do you think maybe sometimes people make mistakes by just diving into, trying to learn the practices versus trying to change their culture first?
I think it's pretty obvious that you have to change your culture for this to stick, right? So you cannot go, we're just going to adopt practices. We're going to leave the company culture exactly as it is. So you have to change culture. There is something about whatever an organization's culture is that has molded the organization, the company into the current shape, right? That's made us do, annual budgets and predictive plans way in advance, and the org chart looks the way it does. All of that stuff exists because of the culture, for good or bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but the culture has shaped the organization in a certain way. And if we want to change things and we want those changes to stick, we're going to have to change the culture, or you're going to get kind of pulled back right into the exact same, I always think of it as shape, that the organization is in today. And so when we're making a transition or transformation, and again, confusing to know which term is better, different companies like different terms, but when we're trying to change an organization to work in a more agile way, you need to make the change significant enough that you achieve what I always call like an escape velocity, right? You got to escape that gravity that's going to pull you right back into looking the way you do. So we have to change enough to achieve that escape velocity. Where things get interesting for me when you bring practices into that discussion is there used to be a lot of discussion in the Agile community. I'm going back to like the early 2000s. A lot of discussion back then about should we adopt the Agile practices or should we first embrace the Agile principles, which are kind of more cultural. And there was a lot of debate about that. I don't hear that debate that much anymore, where people seem to be, we need to understand their principles. Let's kind of start there. But I think there were a lot of good arguments in favor of starting with the practices. And a lot of them were often couched in the terms of the old movie, The Karate Kid, right? Think about The Karate Kid as the perfect movie demonstrating going through the practices without knowing why, right? And so you got the, you know, the kid waxing on forever and kind of wondering, like, when am I going to learn the karate stuff, right? And lo and behold, he's learned the karate stuff, right? And so I think there is some merit to having a team start with practice. I'm not going to say it's necessarily the way to go, but as opposed to starting with understanding their principles. But I think I've definitely seen successes with the companies where we have not spent a lot of time focusing on why we're doing the things. We're just going to put the team, this is going to sound bad, but I'm going to say this anyway. We're going to put the team under some pressure to get something done in 2 weeks. I'm not talking about soul crushing pressure, but like, hey, team, deliver something. And if a team is under pressure to deliver something in a couple of weeks, again, not aggressive, but just something, they don't have time for the politicking and the fighting and the arguing, the bickering. They just kind of buckle down and get something done and learn how to collaborate and prove to themselves, yeah, it is possible to do something, maybe not much, but something in a very short time period, like 2 weeks. And so I've had a lot of successes with organizations where we start with the practices. Back to the principles, the culture, you got to change those eventually. Do you always have to start with those? I don't know. I think there's a lot of room for starting with practices as the lead in a transition to Agile.
I'm going to make a note here. According to Mike Cohn, if you want to be successful with Agile, have your team wax your car.
That might be a good way to go about it. Have your team wax your car and then teach them that they just learned how to be Agile.
There you go.
Could be a way to do it. So
you just saved a bunch of companies a lot of consultant money right there. There's obviously a lot of bad Agile out there. There's a lot of people who have gone down the wrong path. And I do want to try to help steer people away from that and help them find ways to be more successful, even just some, you know, short tips from them. And as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about just the number of times I've seen organizations that put together an initiative to go Agile. They think it's a 6-week process. They don't get any kind of training. Everyone's has different definitions for these different terms. Some of them have just come through a grapevine. Some of them have come from some bad blog post article online somewhere. So I'm curious your kind of thoughts there. What are some things you think people really need to get right if they're going to be successful with this?
You know, I want to start with a kind of a higher level answer to that. Because you asked about, you know, we're talking about transitioning, right? And one of the things that I think really causes problems is when somebody names the transition, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, this is the Get Agile 2022 initiative or something like that. And there was a book that came out many years ago called Nameless Change. And it's by Glenn Allen Meyer. In his book, he talks about this. He says, like, the worst thing you do is name your change initiative. Because once you've named it, now it's got a target on its back, right? I would have been the guy too, right? You're going to make fun of the you know, improving our company 2022 initiative, right? I would have been laughing about that. And so I don't want to name the transition effort. I just, you know, it's just low key. It's just us getting better. We're always going to be focused on getting better. And why do I have to name this one, right? It's just what we do. We get better at stuff. That should always be part of our culture. Back to the culture idea. And so one thing is to kind of avoid naming it. You name it, you draw attention to it. People think it's going to end at some point and it's not really going to end. So I think that's one of the most important things to do.
I can't agree more. And it's kind of like the idea of saying, hey, we're going to have a learning initiative and we're going to just all of a sudden cross learning off our list.
Yeah. You know, done learning. Yeah. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. It's never going to end. And so I hope people get that is that, you know, even teams that have been doing this for a long time, they don't feel like, oh, well, we've arrived. We're finally on the top of the heap and we don't need to do any more work. Part of this is the whole inspect and adapt thing. You know, it's this constant mindset of what can we improve? How can we find things that aren't really working so well and tweak it and experiment and try new things?
The whole idea of continual improvement is something I got attacked on LinkedIn a little while ago. I had posted something totally in line with what we're saying, which is, you know, hey, always try to get better. Always try to get better. And somebody attacked me, and I'll comment on that in a second. And then others kind of jumped in on it. But the initial attack was like, lay off, man. You know, enough's enough. Teams get good. evil corporations have to start asking the team to get better, have to stop asking the team to get better, right? Enough's enough. They don't have to get better all the time. And I'm like, whoa, that is not at all what I'm talking about. And I think about it from the perspective of something like a professional athlete. Pick any sport. It doesn't matter. And, you know, I don't care how good that athlete is. They are always, if they're good, if they're like truly professional, they're always trying to get better, right? And you get somebody who is past their prime, they can't jump, they can't run as fast, whatever it is. They've lost some physical skills, but they're working on maybe their hand-eye coordination. They're working on their diet, improving their diet, whatever it is, they're trying to be the best they can be. And it, let's say 42, no, they're not going to be as good as they were at 27, right? But they're always trying to get better. And they're not doing it for the evil owner of the sports team, right? They're doing it for themselves and their pride. And that's what I want with teams. I mean, that's why we try to get better. I just want to be the best I can be at something, not so that my evil manager can drive a fancier car, right? I want to do it for my own pride. And it was just interesting to see getting attacked for having that perspective of we should always try to be getting better at our jobs. And it's like, no, man, lay off. People are, you know, teams, some teams get good enough and they shouldn't have to try to get better anymore. It's like, wow, that's about the most anti-agile thing I could imagine hearing.
Yeah, that does not sit right with me either. I mean, it makes me think back to that whole Dan Pink thing about autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And just the mastery part of this is, I know for me, it's a big motivator just to think, you know, I don't want to just become comfortable and sit where I'm at and think, you know, I'm done. You know, I'm a big American football fan here, as you know, and, you know, Tom Brady just retired. He's one of the greatest quarterbacks that has ever played the sport. He didn't just, you know, finish a season, you know, before he played this last season, he had won the Super Bowl. He didn't take the off season off and just sit around and think, I can go back and do the same thing next season because I'm already at the top. Yep. No, he worked. He strived. He worked on his mechanics. He ate right. He did everything he could.
He knew he wasn't at the top of his game, but he thought he still had more in him. And he's a great example of what I'm talking about. I mean, but you know, pick a figure skater, a golfer, anything, and they're not as good physically as they were at some younger age. But it doesn't mean they give up on trying to be the best they can be. Right? I had back surgery, and I'm trying to be the best I can given the back surgery. Right? So they're trying to do whatever they can. I read a really interesting, very inspiring story from a, I think she was a downhill skier who had lost, I think, both legs. Wow. And I mean, I would just, and I hate to say this, I would just kind of give up. I would not try to ski again. I'd hope I could do anything, but I don't think I'd have that drive in me. And then she was competing in the Paralympics and winning gold medals there. And she has to know she's not probably the same skier that she was, but be the best you can, right? And that needs to be, that continual improvement needs to be part of a good agile team's mindset, even though they may know we lost our great DBA. We're not as good as we were last year. The DBA moved on, founded a company, great for our DBA, but we're not as good as we used to be. You still try to be the best you can, given your context.
Yeah, agree. You know, going back to the sport metaphor a little bit, you know, on the opposite end of kind of the Tom Brady thing, you often see rookies in any sport who are naturally gifted. And, you know, it's that kind of an old Hollywood trope of where you have that person who is, you know, big and strong, and they have all the physical talents that they need to be enormously successful at what they do. And yet they just aren't very successful because they don't have that drive. They don't have that inner motivation to say, this is part of who I am.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the story you just said about the skier, you know, I get what you're saying. And I agree. If I went through something catastrophic like that, I don't know that I would have the drive. But on the other hand, if that's who I am, right? If that's sort of how I've lived my life and every day has been practicing, and, you know, it would be hard to just one day turn that off and say, I'm not doing this anymore. So I sympathize. I can see how that would, you know, maybe you drive yourself to continue to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, I did want to also include for us a question that this is a question that I get quite often in class, and I'm sure you've heard some variation of this question as well. I like to try to include some kind of a question from someone outside of the people that were going to be here in the podcast. So the question here is, about Scrum and Scrum being one of these agile frameworks we talked about, one of those brands of refrigerators or flavors of ice cream. So people sometimes ask me, what are the other flavors? What are the other kind of things that people do here in the agile frameworks? Are there ones that still are used, that are commonly used? And why would a team pick one over the other? Is there a reason to choose one of these other agile frameworks over something enormously popular like Scrum?
Well, I think there's a ton of agile frameworks out there. I mean, just to name a few, there's things like Scaled Agile, there's Large Scale Scrum, there's DSDM, there's Disciplined Agile Delivery, Lean, Kanban, Extreme Programming, Feature Driven Development, Crystal. So there's quite a few agile frameworks out there. My view is largely that it doesn't matter where you start. Pick a process, start with that. And if you go about the process, whatever that process is, as long as it has some aspect in there of continual improvement, right? And of, you know, retrospective, reflect, get better, improve, you're going to invent your own version of Agile. And you're going to end up at the same place, whether you start with DSDM or feature-driven development or Scrum or Kanban, you're going to invent the right process for you. Now, of course, it would be nice to pick a process that's close to where you're going to end up, right? So, you know, pick semi-intelligently where you go, but you're going to end up in the same place over time. I'm a big fan of saying that if I could take somebody to visit a team that I've coached and they could watch the team, but I probably want to like have them wear earplugs so they can't hear the team, they would have no idea what process they're following. I want to put earplugs on so they don't hear words like Scrum Master, right? You hear Scrum Master, you know, oh, this team's doing Scrum, right? But if you could watch the team, you would see them doing a mixture normally of Extreme Programming, Scrum, Kanban, maybe a few things that would be correlated to bigger processes like Scaled Agile or Large Scale Scrum, but they'd end up in the same place pretty much regardless of where they start. But I do think it's wise to think about your work and see if there's a good starting point. I think Scrum is the ideal process when what you're trying to do requires a highly innovative solution under an aggressive deadline. You're trying to find a way to do something faster or better than it's ever been done before. And that kind of goes back to one of the very first Scrum projects back in the beginning of Scrum was a project at Fuji Xerox, where a company was told to build a photocopier that runs at today's state of the art that sells for half the price, got 2 years to do it. Now, 2 years was aggressive deadline back then. Today would be a lifetime. But that was a very aggressive, required a lot of innovation to make that happen. So I think that type of project is well-suited for Scrum. Projects that are more about getting the user interface right, prototype a lot, experiment with the user interface, DSDMs are really good fit for something like that. Kanban is a great approach when a team is more about managing the flow of work. They're not necessarily trying to innovate a new photocopier at today's state of the art for half the price, but they're managing a flow of a lot of changes to an existing product or support tickets, things like that. We see a lot of Kanban success stories there. So various processes can be good starting points, but I really do think if you're aggressive about continual improvement, you're going to end up at the same point.
And see, I love what you were saying earlier in that about just the, if you walked in on a team, you know, it may have little bits of this and little bits of that. One of the things I talk about quite a bit in class is when we go into talking about scaled frameworks, I'm not a big proponent of any one framework, but I think there's a great thing that happens sometimes where people just, they have a problem they're trying to solve. They find the right practice to fit that problem, and their version of how they've scaled up in their organization might look entirely different from how other people have done it. I think that's a sign of maturity, really. You know, you think about things like the Spotify engineering culture videos that are out there with Henrik, and he does a great job there of just kind of trying to walk you through their journey. But, you know, he also says there, don't copy us because this was our journey. This was how we ended up where we were. Another kind of illustration of that. I mean, think about someone like, one of these celebrity chefs like Gordon Ramsay or somebody, you know, they're not following a strict recipe every time they sit down to make something. They're advanced. They've been doing this for a long time. So they know because they followed recipes early But now they know where they can bend that. Now they know where they can add a touch of salt here or, you know, whatever. I'm such a terrible cook or baker. I can't do any of that stuff. But I imagine that, you know, they feel that freedom to be able to experiment and try new things. And that's how he invents these, you know, just amazing dishes that he serves at his restaurant. He's just trying new things and trying to see what fits here.
Well, I was making a recipe for dinner last week, and it called for 15 shallots, which is a lot of shallots. And I asked my wife to, she was doing an online grocery order. And I, you know, sent her an email saying, I need these. And she saw 15 shallots and assumed it was a typo and changed, you know, ordered two shallots, thinking I meant one and 1.5, not 15. And so she ordered 1.5, got two shallots. And I started to cook the dinner, and I'm like halfway in, and it's like, add the shallots. And I'm like, we've got two. Where are the other 13? I literally stopped cooking dinner and ordered a delivery because I didn't know what to do when we're missing a shallot. A shallot is something I know is a food, but I don't know that I've ever cooked with them before, and I didn't know what to replace it with. And you're right, Gordon Ramsay would have said, oh, let's put in some green onions, I learned later would have been a good substitute. But I didn't know. I just literally stopped cooking and ordered from the Thai place to have delivery. So I can't make those substitutions, right? But you're right, a Gordon Ramsay could.
Well, and see, we have something in common there, because there have been times I've cooked where I've been in the middle of cooking and ordered something to be delivered instead. Wasn't because I ran out of ingredients, though. Just because I tasted a little bit of what I was making and thought,
that extra salt you put in, that'll do it.
Yeah, so. Right. Right. The pinch too much. Pinch too much. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been great. I really appreciate you joining us and being here to kick us off and, you know, kind of our maiden voyage through this thing. Will you come back? Will you be back on some others?
Absolutely. Whenever you want me. So
see how I put him on the spot there? Now you have to.
I'll do it.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Mike.
Thanks, Brian.
I really appreciate Mike joining us here for this first inaugural episode. And don't miss the next episode where Mike will join us again. And we'll be doing a deeper dive kind of discussion about one of my favorite parts of Scrum, Scrum Master. In the meantime, if you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show. It really helps. And we read every single review. Also, make sure that you subscribe so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. Remember, this is a show for you. So if there are subjects you'd like us to discuss, questions you'd like us to answer, or just want to get in touch and share your thoughts, we want to hear from you. Send an email to podcast@mountaingoatsoftware.com, and that'll come straight to us. We also hope you'll tell your friends about us. If you work with other Agilists and you're looking for a high-quality Agile podcast to listen to, well, we hope maybe you found a home with us. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Agile Mentors Podcast.